And our special guest tonight, Patrick Buchanan. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines, give you a chance to talk with Pat, author of Day of Reckoning. We'll be back with more on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie with Patrick Buchanan, Day of Reckoning. Pat, I notice you've written in your book, Day of Reckoning, some sections about John F. Kennedy. We just had our anniversary program. I can't believe 44 years have already gone by. I've always felt that this country lost something, obviously, that day when he was killed, much more than a president. We lost part of ourselves. Has anybody ever asked you what you think happened that day in Dallas?
Oh, yes. I've talked often with folks, and of course, I'm somewhat older than you, George, and I can recall exactly where I was. It was the St. Louis Globe Democrat. I had just written a piece Friday, which was going to be published in the weekend edition of the Globe Democrat, which went to bed on Friday night and was sold all weekend. And the piece talked about how Goldwater was going to win the nomination, probably, and had a real shot at the election because Kennedy was weakened, and he had lost a lot of the elan and a lot of the appeal that he had had with Vietnam and other problems. He was 3 years into his administration. And we had to pull it, obviously, and we put black borders instead of the lines that run down the front page of a newspaper to divide the eight columns. We had very black lines. And yes, we talked about it even at that time. My friend Denny Walsh, who was a famous reporter, he went out and fired a rifle exactly like Oswald's. And they wrote an article because it was argued then that you simply could not get off those three shots in the 5 seconds he is said to have gotten them off and done that kind of damage. And so there, ever since then, there have been stories about Oswald, and was there a second gunman, and was there complicity by the mafia, and was there complicity by Castro or the Soviets? And yes, I followed those stories for years. My own conclusion, and it's not expert, is that Oswald was a single shooter, but his time he spent in Mexico City, it would not have surprised me if Castro knew what was coming and had given it something of a benediction because of the alleged Kennedy plots to murder him, which had come to light and he had discovered. I mean, I don't have any hard evidence for that, but what happened, I remember seeing that Jack Ruby murdering Oswald as he came through that Sunday morning.
I know. That was incredible. And you, in St. Louis at the time, either worked with Dick Amberg or G. Duncan Bauman.
Well, Richard Amberg was my publisher, and I was his young editorial writer. I'd become an editorial writer, as a matter of fact, within a few weeks of arriving at the Globe Democrat in around August of 1962, just before the missile crisis. And Richard Amberg was the publisher, and Duncan Bauman was the business editor at the time. And we were all had the same row of offices. There were five offices down there, Amberg's and the editorial editor, Ham Thornton, in my office, and Charlie Pearson, who was the executive editor, and Duncan Bauman.
Small world, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It was a wonderful world at the Globe Democrat. I really loved it. It had a real spirit. It was a very conservative newspaper. The Post-Dispatch was one of the most liberal in America, and it was very famous. But, George, we were winning the battle for circulation. We had the morning position.
Yeah, you were. That's right.
And the trouble was a secret deal to share the profits between the Newhouse Company and the Pulitzer Company.
Yep.
So when we would win the battle, we'd have to share the winnings.
And basically, they shut down the Globe Democrat and still got part of the profits.
They shut down the Globe Democrat and made the Post a morning paper.
Yep, absolutely. And now, of course, Pat, newspapers all, and this is another part of Day of Reckoning, because this is important, because a lot of people now are getting most of their news from television. You know, our program is a national show known for mysteries and different things like that.
Right.
But newspapers are dying all around the country. The internet has picked up dramatically. What happens when those papers go out of business?
Well, I deplore it because, you know, I'm a Columbia School of Journalism graduate. I love the feel of a newspaper. I've read them since I delivered newspapers, since I was very, very young. The Old Times Herald, I was born and raised in Washington. The Old Times Herald and the Washington Post, when we had four newspapers in D.C. And when I was in journalism school, there were seven active newspapers in New York. Three of them died in my almost in my first year in St. Louis after because of that strike. And I noticed the numbers that you did, that some publications, newspapers, lost 5% of their circulation in the quarter, I believe it was, or something like that. They were astounding. And I heard a speech by Rupert Murdoch where he said, you know, the last newspaper is going to be published on the April 22nd or something, 2042. I'm going to miss it myself, but I think how is it going to affect society when we all get our information off the net?
Yes.
And the newspapers are on the net, and there's an enormous multiplicity of voices. And in other words, with newspapers, whether you agree or disagree, they're down to one or two in a town. And so you get this diversity of voices that you get now with television, with all these different channels. It's hard to see how you get, look into niche markets of terms of news, what they want. It's hard to see how a great country remains, you can get it focused on some great idea or single idea when you've got so many a multiplicity of voices. I don't know what's going to happen, but I do think something is really going to be lost that's irreplaceable.
And young people nowadays, Pat, they're watching everything off the net. I mean, they're watching their video. If they're reading news sites, they're getting it off the internet. I don't think they've ever gone outside to pick up a newspaper.
I think that's right. And many of them, I think Colbert, they get their news from Colbert and Stewart. And those are the main news sources. Colbert was going to run for president. And that's right. They don't read. They don't have the habit of reading newspapers at all.
Heck, you open up the door to let your dog out to get the paper. He comes back with a computer monitor in his mouth.
<That's right.
laughs> It's changing.
The birds are looking for computers. Lying the bird cages.
Exactly.
With computer paper.
And chips and things like that.
Right.
So this country of ours has got this massive credit crunch. The dollar is collapsing. The housing market is screwed up. People are losing homes. Did somebody set us up where this dollar has plummeted the way it has?
Well, I will say I've been predicting for years, because here's what's been happening. The United States, when it had when we had an economically nationalist trade policy all the way up to World War II, was the world's creditor. We became that at the end of World War I, when all the Europeans had to borrow from us to buy weapons and food and everything to fight the war, and the Germans and the Russians were finished. And so what happened, we became the world's creditor, and then we embraced sort of free trade, initially to help out Europe and Japan, which I understood, but we continued to embrace it. And with the Kennedy round around 1969 of trade negotiations, the United States has run 35 straight trade deficits. In the last 5 years, we've had five straight world record trade deficits. Last year, it was $764 billion. In merchandise, we had a surplus in services. In merchandise, it was $836 billion. And there's been $5 trillion in total trade deficits since NAFTA. So every country or every continent in the world, every great country, China, Mexico, Canada, Europe, all run surpluses at our expense. All these dollars are pouring out and pouring out. And that's what I mentioned in the last hour. They got them into the treasuries of these and the exchequers of these countries. And then they say, well, look, we're not making much money on it, 3 or 4%. Why don't we buy up American stocks? And why don't we buy up American companies?
Right.
Because the return is much better. And so now with all those dollars sloshing around, they suddenly are saying, wait a minute, those dollars might not be worth as much as they were. And what corrects every great long-running trade deficit is the decline of a currency. And Buffett realized this, and Buffett got into foreign currencies 3 or 4 years ago. Initially, it didn't work, but now he's making money hand over fist by betting against the American dollar. And as the currency goes down, the country goes down. I mean, these dollars, you and I have probably got saved, and in maybe they're in stocks or bonds or savings accounts. They're losing their value in the world economy. They can buy far less. I'm up here in New York. The prices are unbelievable. The Europeans are coming in and buying things up. And this was inevitable. once you ran this globalist trade policy while every other country acts in its own national interests.
And jobs are just flying out the back door. I mean, you see companies every day saying, we're going to lay off this, we're going to do this. I mean, it's all over the place. Banks are going to lay off 10,000 people. Mortgage people are getting laid off. I mean, it's all over the place.
It is. Well, look, under Bush alone, we've lost 3 million manufacturing jobs. One in every six we had in the United States. Manufacturing now accounts for only 10% of the American labor force. In 1950, it was 33% of the labor force. Manufacturing accounts for less of the labor force than it has since before the Civil War. What we're exporting, George, is, well, obviously we're exporting products, but we're importing far more, but we're exporting our factories. We're exporting our technology. We're exporting our knowledge. And all these are being brought, sucked in by China and Japan and these other countries, which want to be the nations of the future as we are the nation of today. And they have their policies. They manipulate their currencies. China, for example, reduced the value of its currency 45% back in 94 to give it a competitive advantage over the rest of Asia. And as a consequence of that, the Chinese can't afford American goods, but China can sell their goods very, very cheap.
Yes.
And so the idea there is not simply to get us hooked on their products, but to get us to put their factories there. And this is where you get into greed. Many American companies simply have to shut their plants down here in order to compete and move to China. But the greed is many American corporations now call themselves global companies. Their ideal is to get rid of their American workers, but keep their American consumers. And so they shut their plants here, and they make sure, however, they can get their products back into the United States free of charge.
Pat, the Chinese refused to let the USS Kitty Hawk into Hong Kong for Thanksgiving, to let the sailors have some fun and with friends, family, and people who are out there. Refused to let them in. And I'm looking at this story saying, now we're their biggest buyer. So we're basically their client, and they're treating us this way. There's something strange going on here with China. It's almost as if, on one hand, we're being tricked and manipulated. You know, as you just said, corporations are constructing factories in China. They're selling goods here. They're going to go after Taiwan one day. I know it. I can feel it. And I'm not sure we're going to be in a position to do anything about it.
Well, less and less are we able to. That's right. I think they're going to wait until after the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
You recall Hitler did not go after the Sudetenland and Austria until after the Berlin Games of 1936, where he, to quote, he cleaned up his act in Germany to a degree. They eased up on the Jewish population. And then he went after the Sudetenland, and then he Austria, and he went after Danzig after the Berlin Games. Now, China wants to have a successful Olympics, but after that, I agree with you. I think they're going to be going after Taiwan. Let me interrupt to say, I think the reason they did the Kitty Hawk thing was in retaliation for Bush publicly meeting with the Dalai Lama. That enraged and outraged them, and the Chinese have insulted Germany also, because Merkel, the chancellor, also met with the Dalai Lama, which is now the Chinese are terrified of these problems that tore the Soviet Union apart.
Mm-hmm.
And the problems are not simply a demand for freedom. They are the ethnic tensions and the separatism of Tibet, the Uyghur peoples, in the Muslim peoples in Western China. There are millions there who want to pull away and associate with those, some of the Central Asian countries with which they have more in common than the Han Chinese. And the Chinese are terrified of those separatist tendencies and terrified of the minority faiths like Catholicism and the Falun Gong and others. But on Taiwan, they have positioned 900 to 1,000 missiles opposite Taiwan. They've been adding 50 to 100 every year for almost a decade. And there are 900 to 1,000 missiles there, and they are constructing their armed forces, configurating them to fight a naval war off their coast. And there's only one naval power out there. They have anti-ship weapons. A submarine recently surfaced in the middle of an American battle group out there. They tested at the beginning of the year the ability to kill satellites because they know that's how the Americans fight, with the global positioning satellites guiding our weapons and things. And so I think they are taking their time, but the flashpoint would be if the Chinese on Taiwan and the Taiwanese declared independence, I think you would have a crisis. And on that one, I think the Chinese would unite and fight.
I think so, too. Absolutely. And again, would we have any response?
Well, you know, we're now in a position we did in 96. We put two carriers and sent them through the Taiwan Strait. And China backed down. And, of course, they famously backed down in 1958.
Yeah, but they're stronger now.
Oh, they're so much stronger now. And one reason is, George, they've been spending 15% increase a year on defense. And this year it's 18%. All that money we're sending to China, they're using it to buy submarines and to build their own weapon systems. They buy weapons from Israel. They buy them from Europe. They buy them from Russia.
War has become a technological war. I mean, if you've got the equipment, if you've got the armory, you can do what you have to do. Your troops merely come in and sweep things up, like we did originally in Iraq before we got into this quagmire.
Well, exactly. The way that, I mean, no force in the world can stand up to the U.S. Army in modern conventional warfare.
No. One-on-one, there's no way we can be beat that way.
No. I mean, you see the American tanks, for example, even in the Gulf War, it's one shot, one kill. They've got these laser-guided weapons and things that they were hitting the Iraqi tanks before they could virtually see the American tanks. And or could fire and hit the American tanks, and we're firing shells from that kind of distance, moving with tremendous speed and mobility. I don't know that we've lost hardly anything. It's one of a significant tank battle, and they lost, I think, hundreds of tanks. And, of course, they got almost World War II or post-World War II vintage tanks, and the Americans are so efficient, and the American planes and the cruise missiles and the munitions we have are so accurate and so powerful and so lethal, we can kill, frankly, people without far less collateral damage. You remember World War II? I'm sure you read about it, George. I mean, enormous numbers of civilians died in these bombings and things.
Oh, yeah.
And it's much more precision bombing now. People still die. There's no doubt about it. But it's far more precise. They got drones and things like that that the other forces can't cope with. But the Chinese saw that. They were astonished by the Gulf War. And they were astounded also by the rapidity with which the Americans moved into Baghdad. You're right. And, of course, the way the Arabs fight, though, however, the way they've always succeeded in expelling occupiers is they let them come in and then they engage them at close quarters where the advantage of technology and modern weaponry and things are really reduced. And you're back there to in effect, roadside bombs and snipers.
And how easy would it be for the Chinese to nationalize all these companies that have built these factories in their country?
Oh, they could do that overnight. But yep. I'll tell you, one of their problems is, and if you've already alluded to it, is China last year, as I mentioned, I may have mentioned, had a trade surplus with the United States of $233
yep.
billion. Dollars.
We're the best client.
they sell to us. That is equal almost to their entire economic growth. It's almost 10% of their economy.
We're the client they should take to dinner every night.
Exactly.
Yep.
But what they say, and they realize, is they say, is, okay, you're the folks that buy all our goods, but at the same time, we lend you the money because you don't save anything.
Mm-hmm.
We lend you the money to pay your deficits and things like that. And if we take all the $1 trillion or more in T-bills and bonds, and we throw them on the world market, the dollar will collapse. And so we can bring you down. It's called mutual assured destruction.
Yeah, yeah. And believe me, I think they're using that as a wedge, aren't they?
They suggested that. When one Chinese spokesman got up and said, when the economy was shaky and you had the subprime thing, maybe we're going to get out of dollars, and the dollar suddenly sinks and the market goes down.
Yeah, stay with us. Pat, hold on. We'll be right back. Okay, we'll take your phone calls next hour with Pat Buchanan. Then the final hour of the program, I've got Richard C. Hoagland joining us, head of the EnterpriseMission.com, a New York Times bestselling author, Dark Mission. He's going to react to this push to go to Mars by 2031. Back with Pat Buchanan on Coast to Coast AM. Pat, are we going the way of the Roman Empire? Do you see that happening here?
Oh, I think there are real resemblances between the United States of America today and the Western Roman Empire in the 4th century A.D. In an earlier book, I wrote about how a Roman emperor, about 375 A.D., some Goths had been driven basically by the Huns toward the Danubian border of the empire, and the emperor was a good man, and he didn't require them to disarm when he brought them into the empire. And 2 years later, they killed him in a battle. But the idea there was that the unresisted immigrations are a sign of the end of civilizations. George, I really, you know, I've been written a number of books now, and I've got one coming up in May called Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. And I've been, you know, I've asked myself, look, we are in the greatest civilization in history. We are the greatest country in all of history. But undeniably, Western civilization, of which we are a part, is guttering out. It is dying. The European nations, all of them, are dying. The native-born populations are not reproducing themselves. Islamic peoples and peoples from North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa are moving into Europe almost unresisted. Europe is aging and dying. It's very rich, as cultures and civilizations mm-hmm. tend to be in their final stage. And you see it happening to America, and a dramatic change in the character and composition of the population, the loss of cultural unity and national identity, the conflicts within, the culture wars, the racial and ethnic conflicts that seem to be growing, and the demands for entitlements. And also, obviously, in democracies, the overspending, the commitments that you cannot meet. Look in Europe at the strikes going on. And I do have to, and the Churchill book, Churchill Hitler book I'm writing, is about how in 1905, the year my father was born, the Western empires and nations like Great Britain, France, Germany, Russia, United States, and Austro-Hungarian Empire, pretty much with the Ottoman Empire tottering, controlled the whole world. And we were moving our civilization into the entire world.
Yeah.
Progress, everybody spoke of it. And then you take a century later and you see where we are, and it is hard not to conclude that we have gone over the top and we are on the downhill slide. And I really believe that, and many of my books have tried to not only chronicle it, but try to find out the big decisions that were wrong and some of the causes maybe which people can't do anything about. You know, if someone talked to me yesterday about, you know, civilizations, you know, they're like human beings. You're young, you're strong, you're successful, and you accumulate wealth and things, and then you age and you die, and it's inevitable, and all your powers are weakened, and it's a long process. But civilizations are the same way.
That's why you got to spend your money, Pat, and have fun now, huh?
No, carpe diem.
Absolutely. 2001, 9/11, George Bush had the support of nearly every nation on this planet, including the Iranians, when he wanted to take out the Taliban. The Iranians didn't like them either.
Right.
How did he blow it?
You know, you're one of the few people, George, who baked the very simple point. The Iranians didn't like the Taliban, and the Iranians didn't like Saddam Hussein.
That's right.
They were delighted. The Americans were coming to crush them. They were fearful the Americans were going to had them next on the list.
Right.
But they were delighted, and they were assisted us passively. You know, planes going over their territory, no protests, things like that. And they assisted us in Western Afghanistan. Your question is, how did George Bush blow it? I have a whole chapter on that because I wrote a column this week. How did George Bush, who's not an unintelligent man, who means well, who's got energy, who is decisive, he's not a deep person, but he could have been an outstanding president. He had the whole country with him and the world with him. And what happened, George, is I believe George Bush was converted, almost like St. Paul was converted, knocked off his horse and converted to this ideology of democratism the ideology that the United States of America has an historic mission to democratize the entire world, beginning with America, then moving out into the rest of the world, and ultimately we're going to democratize the Middle East and the entire world, and if we don't, America is in mortal peril. And you, so I went through all of these speeches the president has delivered. He did not invent these ideas. He converted to them, mm-hmm. and his speechwriters know them, but you read through them, and I call it the gospel of George W. Bush. And he, his beliefs are profoundly deep, but the statements he makes, and they're nicely written, they seem beautifully written and beautifully stated, and wonderful ideas, but they happen not to be true. They're contradicted by history and human experience and common sense. I mean, he talks about all people desire freedoms at all time, and you realize, look, like it or not, the Nazi party got more votes than any other German party in history.
Amazing.
Hitler was extraordinarily popular in the 1930s. I mean, countries, and that all people seek freedom for all, you know, all time. Why then did we have slavery for 1,000 years? So all of these ideas he has about their romantic notions, their utopian notions, and it's a messianic vision. And it will lead us to endless wars and endless conflicts. And then, based on this ideology, he got up and made the Axis of Evil speech, and basically, while we're at war in Afghanistan, the country world with us, threw down ultimatums to three countries, all of them with terrible governments, admittedly, anti-American governments, but none of which had attacked the United States. And I think that was the beginning of the mission to Iraq and the belief that the whole Middle East would, once they saw how we arrived there and liberated them and turned them democratic, they would all follow.
How influential was Rumsfeld and is Cheney with him?
Cheney's enormously influential and very supportive of that ideology. He was at American Enterprise Institute, which is one of the centers of it. Rumsfeld, I believe, is somewhat different in the sense, but Cheney, you know, in 1991, 92, he's got a wonderful statement back there defending President Bush, one, why they shouldn't go to Baghdad, just kick them out of Kuwait and send them back up the highway, mm-hmm. and not take the place over, try to run it or reform it. But Cheney changed. And Rumsfeld, I believe, he went in with a small army because I believe that he would probably have preferred to go in, do the job, and come back out. But why Powell went along without protest surprised me, because Powell had expressed what I think is real wisdom, that you don't go in unless the country is united and you have a plan for what you're going to do and how you're going to exit and when you're going to get out of there, that we're not in the business of taking over nations and rebuilding and reforming them, that we don't have the resources or perseverance or the national interest to do so.
I can't believe that after 6 years, Pat, we at least publicly have appeared to have given up on Osama bin Laden. We're waiting for another one of his statements to come out, which he wants to address to the Europeans. I just don't understand why we just didn't do whatever we had to do to get him. I think the president's popularity would have soared at that time.
Oh, I think if we killed bin Laden, or captured him, even better, frankly.
Yes.
And brought him out the way we brought Saddam Hussein, mm-hmm. out of that rat hole or wherever he was. I think it would have been tremendous. Apparently, George, it was at Tora Bora. He was in that mountain right in there. And apparently we relied on the Afghans to be the blocking force to prevent him getting into Pakistan.
That Northern Alliance, I guess, huh?
And the Afghans, to let them do it, and we didn't bring in or we didn't have enough Marines or Americans to really block every exit out of there when we had him in Tora Bora and we're bombing it with the smart bombs. And that's when he escaped. But it is astonishing that this guy can, these tapes show up at Al Jazeera and these other places, and you know we have enormous technical capacity, why we can't find or kill that individual, or why we can't trace back to him. When you've got, I'm sure it's not only American intelligence, every other intelligence organization, I'm sure we've got spies and agents paid all over the place.
Oh, my God. With the kind of money we're offering, somebody would have ratted on him by now.
Yeah, exactly. And I think people, you're exactly right. They must have ratted on him. And we've got people going in there, I'm sure, that are paid by Americans to go into those areas and just pick up intelligence. and word of mouth. I mean, and he's an easily recognizable figure, and there's got to be all manner of people that have seen him and carry this information out. It does puzzle me, but I think even now, if Bush got him, I think it would be certainly a triumph for Bush. It'd be a tremendous triumph for his party, and it would be an enormous boost to him. But the problem now, George, is that this movement has, if you will, it's like a cancer that metastasized.
Yeah.
If you got it and cut it out.
We should have cut it out years ago.
Should have cut it out years ago. But now, I mean, when you got Al-Qaeda in Iraq and all these imitation groups that see the prestige that Bin Laden's more popular in the Middle East than Bush is. And all these groups that are sort of organized as a, not as necessarily affiliates, but as imitators, you know, of him and pulling off some of these deeds, some of them connected to Pakistan and Afghanistan, some of them independent operatives.
Aren't you puzzled? I mean, thank the God nothing's happened, but aren't you puzzled that nothing really has happened here since 2001?
You know, and yes, I am. And I'll tell you something else is you almost don't want to talk about it, but I am astonished.
It's like bad luck.
But here's the thing. Look, I can understand how we could have blocked now with much more alert. We might have blocked some huge major event. But the truth is, when you take America's malls and stadiums and places like that, how open they are, and how, a conspiracy of a number of people with these satchel explosions, the way they were bombing places in Israel, which is tremendous, which is a very small country, and how many people they were killing there during the height of the Second Intifada, and how easy it would be to carry off really a mass killing in malls at the same time, simultaneously in the United States, where you could kill probably as many people at a Christmas time and times like that.
Well, and there was an FBI bulletin out about the possibility of malls this season.
Yeah, but how could we stop it? I mean, we got tremendous malls in Virginia. They got California, of course, Southern Cal, that Southland Shopping Center, the Mall of the Americas. Everybody knows of these places. Why it hasn't happened escapes me. One reason, almost surely, is obviously some of our security agencies have done a fine job at stopping a number of people. But the second one is the feeling that maybe that wouldn't benefit them as much as another spectacular. And a spectacular takes planning and a long time to pull off.
And maybe maybe they just want this administration to go away. Maybe they say, all right, we see the polls too. He's very unpopular now. Let's just see what happens after the election. Is that possible?
It is possible. And I do think they are very aware of American politics because many of his statements, Bin Laden's statements, have alluded to events in the United States. But the odd thing, you know, George, that tape he sent on the eve of the election in 2004, were they so foolish as not to realize they were going to help reelect Bush and finish Kerry?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm astounded. I do think this. I think Bin Laden was astonished at how the Americans reacted and almost killed him and eradicated Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. But I do believe he was pleased by the fact we invaded Iraq. I think he was delighted. The Americans, here they are. They have marched in, and once they are there and occupy, that is when we can fight them up close, and that is when they will antagonize the whole Arab and Islamic world, and that is when we will get the kind of recruits we need from the young people outraged by what appears to be the American occupation of an ancient Arab and Muslim capital.
You know, Pat, too, I have always felt, just watching how these things are unfolding, that the war machine wants all this to happen. I mean, look at the billions of dollars we have spent in the last 6 years alone to feed the war machine with what we're doing. I mean, it's absolutely staggering. You know, last year, 35 million Americans were declared hungry. And look how much money we've spent just in Iraq alone. And there's no end in sight. And I said in 2003, we will never leave Iraq. And a lot of people said, come on now. It's going to be quick. We're in and we're out. And just last week, the president signed an agreement with the Iraqis, and they're going to negotiate a way for us to stay there almost indefinitely.
You know, when I was working on the book, and I'm working on that chapter of what pulled Bush in there to try to understand how a basically good man, who's not a bad man at all, what could have, and who was speaking of a humble foreign policy in 2000, of not getting involved in nation building, of picking our places where we can move and where we need not move, how he could catch this messianic ideology that would move him in there. Someone told me, said, Pat, go back and read Eisenhower's speech on the military-industrial complex.
Yes.
And here's this mighty war machine we built up, and I was all for it. I supported it, George, and Nixon, Ford, and Reagan's White House, the military buildup. I was all for it. But when the Cold War was over, I said, you know, the war of my lifetime, the whole cause of my lifetime, okay, it's over, but we won the war. Wonderful. Let's come home. Let's get rid of these, you know, these alliances and tripwires for war. We don't want to fight wars. We did the things we did because we had to do it. But there had built up its own momentum, its own vital interest. There is a huge part of the American economy and a huge part of the, if you will, the political elite in the think tanks and in journalism and in politics and in government, which has a vested interest in America being in a global conflict with someone, because that justifies their lives, their think tanks, their causes, their investments, their corporations, all of these companies, they depend on that. If peace breaks out, it's bad news for some people. You know, as I've told people, I says, if we get out of NATO and tell the Europeans, you're rich and you're fat and you're sassy and we defended you for 60 years and a lot of you don't like us, fine. You can defend yourselves. The Soviet Empire is dead. You realize, however, George, you're baking an awful lot of rice bowls. There's a lot of generals over there in castles in Brussels who are going to have to give them up if we come home.
Well, that's right. And also look at this. I mean, this horrible tragedy that occurred in New York in 2001, the buildings are going back up. You know, the Pentagon was hit by something. Some people say a plane. Other people say a missile. Who knows? But that's been fixed and repaired. To these people, Pat, and I call them the elitists, I don't think they care about people. The 3,000 lives that have been lost, they're gone. They don't care. And they just keep moving on and on and on. This doesn't affect them. I mean, this is like we're like pawns on a board, and they're moving us all over the place. They've got their houses. They've got their security. They've probably got their underground bunkers. I don't think they care. There's an arrogance, and you put it on the subtitle of your book, how hubris, ideology, and greed are tearing America apart. Hubris is arrogance. They've got it.
Well, they certainly do. They certainly it is. And I tell you, they got it really in spades. Frankly, it came over a lot of them at the end of the Cold War, and it's bipartisan, George. This isn't simply Republicans or
no.
Bush folk.
It's elitist. I call it Illuminati, but that's me.
You know, at the end of the Cold War, what happened was we woke up and the Russians, the Soviets, had got up and they started pulling the Red Army out of Eastern Europe. We've had our army there in Western Europe. They pulled it out of Eastern Europe. They said the satellite states, the Iron Curtain is down. The satellite states can go free. The Soviet Union is going to break up into 15 countries. The Red Army's gone behind the Urals. And these folks woke up and said, hey, it is our turn. It is our turn to be the world empire. Our great Cold War antagonist and rival, the bipolar world when there were two powers, is over. There's only one. It is our turn to write history, to be the Roman Empire of the present, to succeed the British Empire. Remember, Madeleine Albright made that famous statement, we are the indispensable nation. We see farther than others. All this all, I think, fed into both Republican and Democratic elites that we are now running the world. We decide for the whole world.
Pat, stay with us.
That's the hubris and the arrogance of power.
We're going to be back with your final hour, and we're going to take phone calls with Pat Buchanan. The lines are open now. His book is called Day of Reckoning. We'll also get some of his recommendations on how to fix this mess.